Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues, our relationship with and impacts upon it. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
And joining us by phone from Salt Lake City is Emma Maris. Emma is a professor at UCLA and also an institute fellow there and an environmental writer and author who we've had on the show, Nell.
That's right. Years ago to talk about rambunctious gardens.
And maybe we'll get back to that. Emma, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Happy to be here.
So before we get to rambunctious garden, we got a number of other things we wanted to chat about. The first being your talk tonight at the Natural History Museum of Utah, which helps kick off a lecture series entitled The Essence of Nature 2020. So I thought, give us a little more insight about what you will be talking about tonight.
Sure. So the museum there has put together a really cool exhibit that I encourage all your listeners to check out about nature that's all around you, even in the city. It has a lot of really cool interactive exhibits that help you kind of realize that you don't have to get in your car and drive out to a national park to have a moment of interaction with nature. There's actually nature right outside your door. And I think that's a message that I've been interested in for years, so I was excited to get involved and to come and talk. So my talk tonight is going to be a lot about that subject, about how do we define nature and what kind of cultural currents are behind our definitions, and what happens if we expand that definition out a little bit and stop focusing just on the kind of stuff you might see in a nature documentary and start looking more closely at the stuff that we encounter in our everyday lives.
And then how does that, you know, once we shift that mindset a little bit to think about the nature that is all around us in our everyday lives, how does that shift people's maybe attitude or actions about protecting it?
So I don't have, you know, perfect data on all of this, but my working theory is that people who take action to protect the environment do so because they like the environment, because they like nature and they enjoy it. But not everybody in this country or around the world feels like they have that kind of relationship with nature. You know, many people don't have either the money, the time, or the interest to get in the car and go out to Arches or to Yellowstone. And so they may not feel like they really have a relationship with nature. Broadening it out in the way that I propose and getting people interested in the birds and trees and flowers right here in the city might be a way to get people to have that sense that nature is something that belongs to them, too, that they are a part of, even if they're not the kind of person who goes backpacking, for example. So I'm hoping it will broaden the constituency for nature, the number of people that feel like they have a stake in what happens.
Yeah, as my own personal experience living in the Upper West Side of New York City, I really grew to appreciate quickly the importance of Central Park, not only
right.
as a source of just kind of getting away and just getting to some, believe it or not, quiet, which the park affords. But, obviously it's a beautiful park, and it was an important part of the city to connect with nature, being so close to everyone, millions of people.
Definitely.
Yeah, so I you know, now we live here. I live here in Park City, and we all, you know, we have nature surrounding us 24 hours a day. And sometimes we lose, conversely, we kind of lose our appreciation of that nature that surrounds us, that people spend time and money and their vacation days to come here and enjoy for just 1 week at a time or so. So we have to learn how to appreciate as much as possible nature that is always there, and like you say, Emma, at our back door.
Right. And another thing I'll touch on in the talk is about not being too purist about what counts as nature. Mm. One thing that's going to happen when the climate changes is that things are going to move around, and we're going to see changes in ecosystems. And our instinct is going to maybe be to see all of these changes as negative. But on the other side of the coin, this is actually nature adapting to what we've done to it. You know, we're already seeing bird species move north and sometimes east and west. plant species are on the move. Things are going to change. And if we're not going to be able to accept those changes, then we're going to be in a rough place, because pretty soon there won't be any nature that really counts to us because it doesn't look the way it did 200 years ago. Hmm. So that's a kind of a psychological conversation that I'm hoping to have with the audience as well.
Along those same lines, kind of, does wilderness still exist? Does wild still exist if climate has changed, you know, every square mile of the planet? Or are we kind of past that?
Yeah, that's a great question, one that I've been wrestling with for years. I think that, you know, where I've come down is that we're going to have to accept that every square centimeter of the planet has been influenced by humans, because even places that nobody has ever visited have been changed because of climate change. And that's a tough thing to reconcile. I think that there are some consolations, though. There are still places that we're not actively managing that aren't a farm or a garden or a carefully manicured park. And those places still have a kind of really vibrant wildness to them, even if they're changing, as I just said, in ways that are unfamiliar to us. So the places that we designate as wilderness might change. A place like Yellowstone that's going to be managed very carefully might actually become less wild. And a place like an empty lot in Salt Lake City that nobody is managing might actually be more wild. So it's interesting times. These definitions are shifting under our feet a little bit.
I was thinking, again, you say how nature can change and we have to kind of change our respect for it in that sense. Like up here, birds will migrate. We may get different types of birds here. So they'll still be migrating here, or there'll be changes. And in fact, we may see more types of hummingbirds. So if you're a birder, there's some value or some benefits associated with that, accepting change in that way and being comfortable with it, while other birds may not migrate here as much. So everything is in flux in that sense.
Yeah, so there's going to be some changes that will be delightful, like you say. And in fact, my family, I grew up in Seattle, and pretty within my lifetime, we've seen a lot of bird changes, including hummingbirds now staying year-round. Hmm. But there's also going to be hard tragedies. And the Audubon website has an interesting tool that your listeners can go to if they Google sort of Audubon bird climate change. Where you can type in your zip code and they'll give you kind of a preview of what birds might leave and what birds might come. And that's a really interesting way to start thinking about this.
So you also, I think we'll talk a little bit about how we can kind of preserve biodiversity in this, you know, post-wild world or in this more humanized world. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I think that, you know, one thing that is going to change in our conservation efforts is I think we're going to be less focused on trying to stop ecosystems from changing. As I've just mentioned, some of these changes are actually adaptive to warming or to land use change. But what we're going to try to focus on increasingly, I think, is trying to just keep the biodiversity that we have. So in some cases, this might actually mean helping plants or animals move. This is called assisted migration. The idea is if some plants or animals are stuck in an area and the climate is becoming unsuitable for them and they don't have the means to move to a better area, some conservationists are talking about actually assisting that process.
Hmm.
So there's new techniques like that are coming up and that are being sort of discussed and debated. But, I mean, ultimately, the core of conservation is not that different. We still need to protect areas and connect up all those areas. And that kind of concept of cores and corridors goes all the way back to the founding of the field. So there are some new things, and there are some changes in terms of how purist we're going to be about what's native and where things are. But ultimately, it's still fundamentally about respecting the non-human world and just making room for it.
That's an interesting point, Emma, that I believe we've had a conversation in the past with another scientist about assisted migration in terms of, say, temperature and weather patterns may change that kind of force, say, animals to migrate north, or let's go back to birds, to migrate north. But that doesn't necessarily mean that there will be habitat for them that they're accustomed to where they were, you know, in say a more southern clime. So that that assisted migration helps address what they may be missing as they move north.
Yeah, and it's tricky business because every time you're intervening in this way and moving things around, you risk causing some sort of unintended consequences. So, you know, this is not something we would do lightly. It's something you'd have to do a lot of science on and a lot of community consultation and carefully think about. But I do think it's worth considering when the alternative is losing some of our wonderful species.
We're speaking with Emma Maris. Emma is an environmental writer, author, and a UCLA Institute fellow. She's here this week in Salt Lake City giving a talk at the Natural History Museum tonight. I believe that's at starts at 6 p.m. or so. And she's also going to be giving a talk tomorrow night at the Viridian Center in West Jordan, speaking on what nature means in a changing world. So I wanted to talk a little bit about your op-ed piece in the New York Times just a few weeks ago. Give us a thumbnail sketch about your five-step plan, as you say, for how to calmly tackle climate change once and for all.
Sure. So, you know, as an environmental writer, I often have people asking me, kind of coming to me and for help dealing with their overwhelming feelings about climate change. I mean, this is a big, big thing to try to even conceptualize, let alone deal with emotionally. And many people have a lot of anxiety around it. They have a lot of feelings of grief and depression, all of which I think is pretty normal. I mean, these are huge changes, and it's really discouraging that we've known about this for so long, and we haven't really made the changes we need to make. So people are in a rough place. So I kind of developed some advice to give them, and I eventually thought it would be worthwhile writing it up and putting it in a place where more people could see it. So that's the sort of genesis of that op-ed. Mm-hmm. And my main piece of advice is really to not focus as much on your own personal impact and your own personal carbon footprint and your own household, but really turn that energy outwards and join a group and get together with other people that are fighting for sort of larger systemic change. Because while it is possible to be greener within our current system, within our current kind of city, the way our cities are designed and the way our economy is set up, you can always sort of pay a little extra for the greener option, or you can work a little harder to emit less carbon. Those benefits, as far as reduction, are pretty tiny compared to the scope of the problem. What we really need is big changes in how our cities are designed, how our electricity grid functions, what kinds of, you know, endeavors are incentivized and which ones are regulated. And this, we can't make those big changes just by shopping correctly as individuals.
Right.
But the bonus is that when you do get together with other people who are worried about climate change in a kind of an activist group or some kind of pressure group or lobby group, and you work for those big changes together, that acts as a sort of a therapy, because now you're with other people who are concerned about the same thing, and you're fighting together, and you're doing something about it. And that really lowers people's anxiety and depression when they're actually engaging in the fight. I think that's really the best cure for anxiety on this issue. So the steps are really, you know, stop feeling ashamed, stop focusing on yourself, join a group, figure out what your role in that group could be and what skills you could offer. And then the last step is to keep in mind a vision of what you're fighting for, not just what you're fighting against. We all have these apocalyptic visions in our head of what could happen if nothing is done about climate change. And those are motivating, but we also need to have visions of what a wonderful world we could build if we do make these changes. It won't be just that we stop climate change. It will also be that we'll have these lovely green cities with this reliable, beautiful mass transit, and that there'll be more nature close to us, and that there'll be more wild things around. And those visions, I think, are ultimately more motivating than being terrified of disaster.
I think we've talked about, you know, before on the show how the anxiety and the fear and just the sense of, like, overwhelming you know, odds against us kind of thing have caused paralysis for some people, just a lack of action at all. Well, you know, like if I can't make a difference, then I'm just going to, what's the point? Like, why am I going to do anything? And so I think that's such a great point, is to think about what it is that you care about most. What do you want to see in the future, and how can you get there?
Yeah, and I'd add that for people who have made changes in their lifestyle to try to reduce emissions, I really applaud that, and I think it's great, and it's certainly worth doing if you can. But focusing completely on yourself and not on these bigger systems won't get us where we need to go.
Right. But I do believe that, you know, we all have a shared responsibility in trying to recognize how we consume fossil fuels, in what manner, and where the opportunities are to reduce less. So I like to think that we can do both. I mean, I can take on the actions of reducing my footprint, my eco footprint, my fossil fuel footprint, and at the same time, like you say, join a group and take on, participate in that power of the collective to make bigger, larger, broader changes too.
Definitely. But, you know, I mean, every time I see one of these advertisements that a fossil fuel company puts out that says, hey, you know, use our calculator to calculate your own footprint, I get kind of frankly furious, because
yes,
they are trying to
right.
put all of the guilt on the shoulders of the individual consumer, mm-hmm. even as they have been helped by all the governments of the world to create a world where it's very difficult to live without burning fossil fuels.
Right, and you talked about a group that you joined to, I believe, to address a proposed pipeline?
That's right. They're trying to put a fracked gas pipeline through southern Oregon, where I live. It would go, you know, not far from my house, all the way out to the coast, and then out for export to Asia. So I've been fighting this project with a group of committed activists in my local area. And, you know, I do the math in the op-ed that if I was a perfect green consumer for my entire life, I could never reduce the same amount of emissions that I could reduce by being a part of stopping this project. And if we succeed, it'll be massively more impactful just in terms of raw carbon than anything I could do on my own. And as I fought against it, I have met all these wonderful people who care about the same things I care about that I wouldn't have met otherwise, people that are far from my sort of regular mom, middle-aged mom demographic, ranchers and young people and people from the Klamath tribes. And we've all become, you know, friends in this really exciting way. And we've created this group that can be used later, I hope, to fight for some good stuff too.
Yes.
So I was just going to ask, kind of like, how have you felt that this has impacted your psyche? Like, has it been a frustrating experience? Has it been an uplifting one? It kind of sounds more like that. Is it motivating? You know, do you feel like you can make a difference?
Yeah, it's been. I mean, even if I will be, I'll be honest. If they build this pipeline, I'll be disappointed, because we've fought hard to try to stop them.
Mm-hmm.
But the camaraderie and the working together for a common cause and spreading the word and kind of making that change in my community, it makes me feel so much less anxious, because I know that I'm doing what I can in a large scale effective way. And I go to bed at night now and I feel much less stressed and anxious than I did before I joined this campaign. It's really been better than therapy for me in terms of dealing with my own personal eco-anxiety.
Interesting. And I do like, again, like you say, step five, know what you're fighting for, not just what you're fighting against, and have that idea that there is so many beneficial externalities that go along with trying, again, to reduce our carbon footprint or prevent pipelines from being built, because it benefits our air quality, it benefits our water quality, it benefits biodiversity, it benefits the health and welfare of our future generations. That's what we have to focus on in that, you know, in addition to.
Definitely. And one thing as a reporter, always writing about the newest technologies and breakthroughs in solar batteries and so on. I mean, I feel like we're at the point where we know how to fix this. We mm-hmm. have the technology to fix this. Certainly, there's a little more research that needs to be done in terms of drawing down the carbon that's already in the atmosphere. But But basically, we're there. We just need the political will to get this stuff deployed. And so that's where I think people should be putting their primary focus.
Have you worked with, say, younger generations, the Generation Z, at all? And are you seeing a different mindset in what they're trying to do about this issue?
Yeah, so I've interviewed lots of quite young people for an article that I wrote about youth climate activism, people in their teens. Incredibly inspirational group of kids and adults. And they are, you know, on the one hand, I had really mixed emotions working on that project because on the one hand, I felt kind of bad that my generation, Generation X, dropped the ball here and didn't really get as much done as we should have. Certainly when I was a teenager, I was not fighting to make the world a better place. Mm-hmm. I was, you know, skipping school and trying to be cool. And, you know, I look back at that now and I think, God, how pathetic. So
Don't be too shameful.
And I also work with a lot of activists in their 20s on the pipeline campaign. And, yes. You know, that's I always joke that that's one major side benefit of climate activism is now I have cool friends in their 20s that come and stay at my house.
All right. You're finally cool, Emma.
After
all these years.
It took a couple generations. Well done. And keep up the good work, too, because do you see this? I obviously see this as a climate change issues. As a important political component, we're seeing a lot of people who support our Democratic presidential nominees taking that on and holding the nominees' feet to the fire about climate change, and that's encouraging.
Yeah.
Let's hope it keeps going. So, just to wrap up, you're giving the talk again tonight, Natural History Museum of Utah. Remind me what time again?
Well, I have to be there at a certain time for a mic check, and that's what I have on my calendar. But if you go to the University of Utah, if you go to the Utah Natural History Museum website, it's right there on the front page.
Yes.
So I've got it right
all
here.
All the information is there.
All right.
And I can jump in.
Now save the day.
And confirm that it is at 7 o'clock p.m. tonight. And it looks like you can reserve seats right here online through their website.
Yeah, it should be a fun hour. We're going to, I'll give a presentation. I'm going to be talking about how we define nature and why and what happens when you open that definition up. And there'll be lots of time for Q&A, which is always my favorite part. I love chatting with people about their questions about nature, the environment. Everything's on the table.
Well, that's an interesting point, because do you get pushback during your Q&A sessions? And what does that inform? Does that come in?
Certainly. I mean, there's a kind of a short list of questions that people often ask, and probably my favorite, because I just love the passion behind it, is that when I talk about getting less purist about non-native species, there's always somebody who stands up, and they're usually wearing, canvas pants, and they've got scratches on their arms from gardening, and they say, well, that makes sense to me, but what about species such and such? And there's always one species that they have spent their whole career trying to rip up, and they just don't want to give up that fight. So then I always tell them, look, it's very specific to whatever site you're working on, whatever place, whatever your goals are, and if that plant doesn't fit in with what your goals are for the place where you're working, then by all means remove it. You know, this is not about anything goes.
Right. So this is not about welcoming invasive species.
Mm-hmm. Sure. If there's a species that's causing a legitimate problem, it's thwarting some goal you have, then by all means, remove it.
Right. But if it's a different type of hummingbird or a new type of bumblebee or a plant that fits in with the setting, you're saying that is just a consequence of a warming world that we have to abide by.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, even people who are pretty intensely nervous about, quote-unquote, invasive species do categorize these sort of climate migrants differently.
Sure. Well, Emma, before we wrap up, where is a good place for people to go and read more of your writing and learn more about your work?
Well, Well, I have my own little website. It's emmamaris.com, and I have a section there called clips, which is what we call our examples of our writing in the writing business. And you can see a lot of my, you can find the New York Times op-ed there. You can see a lot of my recent writings about, I have an essay about soil, another interest of mine. So there's a lot of stuff there.
Emma Maris, environmental writer and UCLA Institute fellow, and also the author of the book Rambunctious Garden, Saving Nature in a Post-Wild World. Thank you so much, Emma, for taking the time to chat with us this morning on This Green Earth. And we'll try to get down to the talk, if not tonight, tomorrow night at the Viridian
Sounds
Center.
Great.
All right. Let's take a break for some underwriters. And when we come back, we got some news items to cover and maybe a calendar of event thing or two. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Bill Rock. The Vail Epic Promise Foundation, a nonprofit organization, is a proud supporter of KPCW. The foundation provides Park City Mountain employees with grants and emergencies and for educational purposes. Information is available to Park City Mountain employees at epicpromise.com.
Earl Foote here with Nexus IT, who is a proud supporter of KPCW. Secure on-demand technology is pivotal to the success of today's businesses. Nexus IT offers IT support cloud services that allow business owners to focus on their organizational objectives. 435-487-9099, nexusitc.net.
Do you love music as much as I do? Hi, I'm Christy Dilloway, music consultant to KPCW and a groupie for Great Grooves. I listen to music all the time, looking for the best new tracks for you, adding them to the KPCW playlist to debut as fresh tracks on Fridays. When you hear a fresh track, let me know. Do you love it? Do you hate it? Should it stay or should it go? Post a comment on the KPCW Radio Facebook page, #FreshTracks, or email Christy at kpcw.org. Together, we'll keep the KPCW playlist fresh.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And in the second half of the show today, we have some news highlights from the past week to share with you. And
A couple weeks,
that's right. We had a little break, a little hiatus for the film festival.
Did you go to any films?
I did,
all
yeah.
Right. Maybe
yeah,
we'll talk about that.
Including a semi-environmental documentary,
all
so
right.
We can talk about that.
All right, maybe we'll get
but,
to
But speaking of the human psyche around nature and climate change, we have an interesting piece from Miami.
Yeah, this is out of the Miami Herald with respect to Miami Beach. Now, that's the barrier island in front of Miami, all right? So this is, like I said, not just the engine of when it comes to the impacts of climate change to our coast. Miami Beach is the cow catcher of it, and you know.
I've never heard that phrase before.
I don't know. I just came up with that.
I'm assuming that's the grate in front of the train.
Yeah, that's the cow. That's the thing that would push cows out off the tracks. That's why it's. You didn't know that?
No.
All right. Obviously, you're not from New Jersey, so you don't know everything like I do, or just made it up. But that's what it's called. It's called the cow catcher. So they're on the front lines of the impacts, and they're already experiencing flooding with respect to king tides.
Right. And we call it the sunny day flooding there, right, where it's not raining, it's not a storm, it's just a high tide.
So they hired an engineering firm to evaluate what do they need to do to control rising sea levels, not just in what's going to happen in 50 or 60 years, but now what's going to happen in the next 10 to 20 to 30 years. You know, it's a much closer time frame horizon. And I'll just read the start of the article here. Experts are once again telling Miami Beach to raise its roads against the threat of rising seas, this time even higher.
Right, they've already done this.
They did it back in 2014, said you need to raise the roads this high, and now they've recalculated it 6 years later, and they said, whoops, you know what? You need to raise them another foot or so. I'll get to the particulars of that. Once again, residents are pushing back. City Hire consultants told residents that under their new calculations, emergency roads, not every road, emergency roads would have to be elevated even higher than the city previously called for, but residential roads could stay lower than originally planned. Now, the response from Miami Beach residents is a resounding no way. Ever since the city decided to address sea level rise with road elevation changes, residents have fought back. They point to water overflowing from higher roads onto their property, insurance snafus, and multi-year construction times. And of course, they're going to have to pay for all that. But expert after expert has told the city that to save itself from climate change, the roads must come up. And the longer the city waits, the more expensive and difficult it will be. So basically, the engineers have said, you've got to raise the emergency roads, the really like the primary
critical
roads,
transportation roads,
about 4 feet. 4 feet.
Wow.
1 feet to 1 foot to address anticipated or existing levels of flooding. Another foot or so to anticipate future flooding in the next 20 to 30 years. That's it. And then 1.7 feet or so to address the road base. So now imagine the road that links to your driveway. You just pull in and you set. Now that road is 4.7 feet higher up.
And a you significant
have to,
difference.
So you have to make changes to your driveway to drive up 4.5 feet or so to get onto the road. Imagine where is all the rainfall that hits that road, et cetera. Where is that going to go? That's going to go onto your property. So these are the challenges these people in Miami Beach are facing, and all the knock-on effects associated.
And it points
to
the fact that there's no easy solution. Like, you can't just raise the roads, you know?
No.
Everything else around it will still be submerged.
Yeah, and even more so
where
those roads are. And that's why the folks in Miami Beach, many of them, are saying no to this change. Now, road raising critics like current Commissioner Mark Samulian worry that the raised roads cause more problems than they solve for private property, which could lead to a decline in values. Because at the end of the day, if you own property there, you own a home there, that means a lot.
I have to imagine value. Either way, your property values.
Well, once this article came out, your property value got impacted. And he said, quote, I worry more that we'll raise the roads too high prematurely and damage the fabric of our community and property value of our community. You can always go back and raise the roads later on.
Hmm.
So he's basically saying, we don't need to do anything
incrementally
right now. Maybe to have more incremental, not such a dramatic 4.5 foot rise in these road levels.
I could see how it would impact community, though. When you think of a road that's 4.7 feet, almost 5 feet higher, that's like almost a wall. That's like a barrier. More than a connector.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're right. You're right. So, but NOAA's Southeast Florida Climate Compact worked with NOAA, and they're figuring out how much the sea level rise will look like in South Florida, Miami Beach. They say by 2050, they predict 1.3 to 1.8 feet of sea level rise in and around Miami Beach.
Wow.
So not only will they be seeing flooding from king tides, they'll be seeing flooding from normal full moon tides, a lot more normal high tides, a good percentage of the year. That's what a warmer world looks like on coastal barrier islands up and down Southeast Florida and in the Keys too. They're all facing this problem. What do we do about it? Because not only do you have to raise the roads, you've got to beef up the stormwater collection and pumping systems, because you've got to pump that water that collects off the island. You've got to maybe change the underground infrastructure. That also, the sewer collection system is going to be impacted. The groundwater
electric
quality,
lines,
electric lines.
Things,
they have a lot of buried lines because of hurricanes. A lot of cities have now buried their lines. It's much more expensive to do so, but it's much more it addresses the potential impacts from hurricanes. So, but now these lines are going to be inundated much longer periods of time from salt water, and that salt water is very corrosive. So all of these impacts are affecting the residents of Miami Beach and all these other coastal barrier islands out there in Southeast Florida and in the Keys. They're all facing that. What roads do we raise? How much is it going to cost? When do we do it? Right? Do we do it now? Do we do it incrementally?
Right.
And who's going to pay for it? If my road's going to be raised and your road's not, why should you participate in the fixing of my road? And not? So all these questions, again, the psychology of this, the sociology of it, and of course, at the end of the day, it's all about property values too.
I'll be very curious to see how the property values are impacted, you know, over the next few years and how this all kind of plays out.
And
if people are relocating, if people are just kind of selling while they came
Do I sell now?
Yeah.
Or do I hold on? Does it matter? Yeah, you're right. It's all in play with respect to us up here. We don't face that types of conditions, but we face different conditions too.
We're worried about drought and
shorter winters,
yeah,
and the impacts of that on our water supply, et cetera.
Our economy, just like they
and our property values too.
Sure.
Okay. So we have a different set of circumstances here, but that's what's going on in Miami Beach. Let's take a quick break, and we come back. Let's get to your story about bird migrations.
We'll talk
and
about the Migratory Bird Act.
All right. This is Green Earth. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Steve Roney Jr. from Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. We are a proud supporter of KPCW and our Park City community. Our agents are located in Summit and Wasatch counties, and we can be reached at bhhsutah.com or 649-7171.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. We're covering some items in the news. We just talked about Miami Beach and snowbirds. Why not?
Hey, good segue, Chris. Yeah, it's like, God, I like it.
Thank you. You're welcome. Now let's turn to real birds who are much, much friendlier and much nicer to have around. What's your story?
Well, Chris.
Yeah.
So the Migratory Bird Act is an act that's been in place. Gosh, I should know the year that it was put into place. I'll have to look that up. But it essentially acts to protect migrating bird species. So you can't create hazards or barriers or dangers that are going to kill them. And it applies to not only intentional actions, but in the past has always applied to unintentional actions, right? If you create an oil pit that attracts birds because it looks like a pond, then they land and they can't get out. That maybe, of course, was not your intent. That was unintentional, but these birds were still protected under the act, so you were required to address this issue. So just to kind of give an example there.
And BP oil spill is another one, real quick one.
The
intention obviously was not to kill birds as a result of this spill, but BP took upon themselves via the Migratory Bird Act to have to address the impacts that spill caused to tens of hundreds of thousands of migratory birds.
Right.
So that's what the Migratory Bird Act
is. And you know, it also applies to these much smaller scenarios, like things that might play out here locally in Park City are, for example, barn swallows are protected. They're a native bird species. They migrate. They're protected under this act. And, you know, they build their nests and sometimes in locations that are inconvenient for the people living here, you know, on a overhang on your house or something like that.
Or garage or something.
And you can't like knock down their nests with the young in them and with the birds in them. That's illegal because it's a species that's protected by the Migratory Bird Act. And so this kind of plays out on all levels. It's not just for like endangered species or anything like that. It's for all migrating birds because we've seen in the past that when birds migrate from place to place, it's key to protect them all along the route. If they're not protected the entire time, then their population can still be decimated. So, in my opinion, unfortunately, the Trump administration is working to cement new standards, weakening enforcement of the century-old Migratory Bird Treaty Act. This is from the Washington Post. They say Interior Department officials said Thursday that they will propose regulations clarifying that individuals and industrial operators, such as oil, gas, and wind companies, will not be penalized if they accidentally kill birds, even if it's on a massive scale. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Director, Aurelia Skipwith, said the new regulatory language is needed so that private industries, quote, can operate without the fear and uncertainty that the unintentional consequences of their actions may be prosecuted when birds are killed, end quote. Officials said that they'll rely on companies to voluntarily protect birds.
Voluntary. So if there is a spill, or like you say, they build a, construct a pond that has a lot of industrial waste in it, and birds die from mistaking that pond for actual clean water, they can't be held liable in a formal way, be fined for it or so. Their actions hopefully will be based on the company's goodwill.
They just hope the company will do the right
thing.
So the administration first released their interpretation of the law and their own guidelines in April of 2018. And since then, there have been, you know, cases that the administration hasn't been following up on. It's like, okay, there was an oil spill from this boat. Here's the identification. They say, oh, well, it was unintentional, so we're not going to follow up on it. So I think, you know, just for context, in May, a UN report found that 1 million plant and animal species are on the verge of extinction as a result of human activity. And then 4 months later, a report by ornithologists and government agencies found that nearly 3 billion birds across hundreds of species have been lost in North America. So with that in mind, at least 7 attorneys general and several conservation organizations challenged the administration's opinion on the Migratory Bird Treaty Act in federal court. And we'll kind of see what happens as this plays out. I want to give the information here.
Because there is a comment period.
Right. So the comment period just opened on Monday, and now we have 45 days for public comment. If you just, I think, Google like Migratory Bird Treaty Act, Fish and Wildlife Service, you'll find their article, their release about this. And on that page is a link to the federal e-rulemaking portal where you can submit your comments, as well as an address where you could mail them if you'd like. So if you want to comment on this.
Right. Because like you say, the oil and gas industry welcomes this opportunity or this proposed change to the act, because again, they say that, look, companies do the right thing anyway. They know what needs to be done. And if this happens, that they're already practicing the proper thing and trying to protect birds and animals and plant species in the event of these accidental releases or so. And that's what we're going on.
And it's day-to-day operation.
It's faith-based environmentalism. That's what I call it. Faith-based, you know, it's like have faith that these companies, oil and gas companies, and I like the way they threw in the wind industry too.
Right, that's a big one when it comes to birds.
Yes.
Right?
They're practicing the right thing, and they will continue the practice, and they don't need an act like this, a hammer over their heads to do the right thing. So
right. So, you know, previously they were, as they say, expected to take basic steps to protect birds as kind of as part of the global treaty, as part of their operation. And now that wouldn't be there anymore. Right.
Okay. So comment period is open now to learn more about this, the details behind this proposed change. And we have like 45 days or 60
right. There's a 45-day comment period. We're a few days into that. And it's really easy to just find this on the Fish and Wildlife Service website.
All right. Let's take another quick break. And when we come back, we got another news item, a calendar event thing. It's this Green Earth.